Anyhow, we are at 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so, please remute yourself after a question or comment so we can keep background noise to a minimum. And later on this evening, Alan will be posting the contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window as a text file. And we have, I think, 10 topics tonight already, so I think we can go ahead and get started. So I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Yeah, so talking about scams, first item is all about avoiding malware. I saw this article in the PC World. This individual, an Australian writer, hasn't had malware in a decade. So he has seven simple secrets. Well, turns out his seven simple secrets are the things that we all know and do, I hope. Basically, stay away from websites that are somewhat suspect, and especially if you get pop-ups, they can be a disaster. Always use reputable antivirus software. I think everybody probably does that. My Windows firewall is always active. Again, if you're running Windows, that's probably very true. And some people use a secondary firewall on top of that. I keep everything updated. Well, sure, everything should be up to date. And if you want to go with the ESU program on Windows 10, you have to be fully up to date before you can actually get the next set of security patches. I read emails with a skeptical mind. Yeah, I think we should all do that and avoid links and downloading attachments and opening things that you don't know that you can trust, basically. Avoiding links and opening any kind of files, basically, because they may have macros inside them. Avoiding public networks and use a VPN, well, as much as possible, I guess. A VPN doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're safe from all evils, but I guess it could help, depending on how much you trust your VPN provider. And I use strong passwords and multi-factor authentication. And everybody's pushing multi-factor authentication these days. It's pretty hard to stay away from it, but I think it's a good thing, so I think people should. One thing he doesn't mention here is strong passwords. Use a password manager so that you only have to remember one password and all the other ones are available to you in an encrypted database. So hopefully I think we're all doing that. If we're not, you should take a read of that article and maybe go along with some of his suggestions.
And anybody who is using VPN in the hopes that it is going to really protect them, take a look, search back through the archives for Q&A. I've talked about the little the VPN really does buy you. And so a lot of people think that it does an awful lot more than it does. So maybe we need another reminder deck to go at some point, but there is information in the previous Q&As if you search on VPN.
Okay, Chris, so you have a rant, I think.
Yeah, start off with a rant. So I have four, I still have them, but they're about to go to the e-waste. Belkin's Wemo Smart Mini Smart Switches. So these are ones you can plug into the wall, and then you can plug any device into it, and then you can control that. So it allowed me to, I have one in the bedroom, and I have one in the living room, and I had the lamps in those rooms plugged into that. So I could use the Google Assistant to, tell it to turn lights on and off, or be part of a routine, and various things like that. And I could automate things going on and off at specific times, or just tell it by voice to do it at any particular time. And I could actually control them from my phone, from anywhere in the world. I could turn my lights on and off. I had a few frustrations over the years, and I don't know if this really played into the idea of the problems now with Wemo smart switches, but every now and then I would get, cannot contact Wemo right now whenever I tried to just say, Google, turn off my bedroom light or turn on the living room light or whatever. And I would get this, cannot contact Wemo right now. And it would happen periodically, and usually by a day later, it would all of a sudden mysteriously be working again. So they really dropped the ball. So in July of this year, they announced that they're dropping support. Not only will I lose automation features, but essentially they're going to turn into paperweights. Now, they're not totally paperweight. They become totally manual switch. You can't control them through scheduling. You can't control them through voice. Nothing. So there is, if I go back one, actually, back two, you can see at the bottom right-hand corner, there's an on-off switch that is right on the device itself. So they would consider, it could still work as totally manual devices. Now, I could see, you know, losing capabilities that use their servers for automation or for scheduling of things or something. I don't know. But I thought that there should be automation functions that would still continue to work, either controlled by the app, talking directly to the switches, or something like that. To me, that just seemed reasonable that I would still have that sort of level of control. I think I should still be able to maintain static routines that get downloaded from the Wemo app on the phone to the switch itself. Now, there's a possibility, I guess, that that has to go through the Belkin servers.
I'm going to ask her to pack our meal.
We'll mute that. Okay, so I went looking for a replacement because I really did like the idea of these smart switches. First off, I decided I'm no longer going to buy any Belkin product. I think if they are willing to walk away from a product like that, then I don't trust them on other things as well. I don't think there's any logical reason why support had to be dropped on them. So I went looking for a replacement for them, and I read a lot of reviews about all the different smart switches that are out there. I settled on Casa from TP-Link. It had good reviews. It had good capabilities, a few extra capabilities that I didn't have with the Wemo switches. Prices were very good, and it can be controlled through either Google Assistant or Amazon Alexa. And this is what the switch looks like. And I pasted the link into there, into the chat on where you can get them at Amazon. And so, very easy to set it up. You download the Casa app onto your phone, and you have to have a smartphone, and you have to download the Casa app to it in order to get things set up. Then you have to create an account at the Casa website. Pretty easy to do. And then you use the Casa app to connect directly to the smart plug over your Wi-Fi network. And you use that connection to configure the smart plug to be able to connect to your wireless network. All pretty simple to do. And then you can use the Google Assistant app to connect to the Casa app. And there was only one minor issue I ran into with this, is that the Casa smart plugs only operate on 2.4 gigahertz. And for the initial setup only, your phone also has to be connected on 2.4 gigahertz. Now, a lot of people have dual band, and they'll have 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz and maybe even 6 gigahertz Wi-Fi. And they'll often set it up that it's on the same SSID. So, you know, your devices will decide on their own which network to connect to, 2.4 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz. So you have to, if you're in that situation, you have to make sure that you force the phone to connect on the 2.4 gigahertz. The easiest way I found is just move farther away from your router, and at some point it will not be supported on 5 gigahertz, and it will be supported on 2.4 gigahertz, and your phone should switch automatically over to 2.4 gigahertz. You can also temporarily disconnect or disable the 5 gigahertz band at the router, and that would force everything to go at least temporarily onto the 2.4. And you can also configure separate names for your networks, which I do. I have separate names for 2.5 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz, so I force my devices to connect to a specific band. Now, the important thing is after the initial setup, it doesn't matter if your phone is on the same network or any network at all. So the final configuration, so for me, the main use is voice control through the Google Assistant. So I can just say things like, you know, I preface with, you know, the word, I won't say it because all my devices around here will start responding. And I'll say that entity, living room lights off, and it'll turn them off. Or I have routines. I have a good night, and it'll tell me, you know, a bunch of things, time and date, tell me the weather for tomorrow, calendar items that I have on tomorrow, and it'll turn off the living room lights and the bedroom lights. or I say good morning, and it turns on the bedroom light, tells me the date and time, weather for the day, calendar items for the day, and it starts streaming a radio station for me. Or I can say that I'm leaving, and it'll turn off all the lights, well, the two lights that are controlled by these devices. It'll stop the streaming on the radio, and it'll tell me the traffic, and things like that. So it's really, really handy to be able to have those sort of routines as well as direct interaction, turning lights on and off. I did create a couple of schedule items through the Cast app. So living room lights come on at a specific time, and bedroom lights go on and off at specific times. One of the neat things about the Casa ones is you can tell it that it should go out at sundown. And not only sundown, but you can say sundown plus 30 minutes or something like that. So it'll adjust throughout the year so that the lights will come on at a reasonable time for you. And you can also randomize things so that if you're away, the lights aren't coming on and off at exactly the same time every day. You can say randomize it for 45 minutes, and it'll look a little bit more lived in. So here's the Casa plugs that I actually bought. It's the Casa Plug Mini by TP-Link, HS103P4, and I think the P4 is there's four devices in the box, so I bought a four-pack for $45 Canadian, sold and shipped from Amazon. And so I found it to be not a bad solution. That's all I have on that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. Okay, next up I have a YouTube video. This is basically talking about the file formats between OpenOffice, which is the OpenOffice, and LibreOffice, which is the Open Document Format, ODFs. So you have like text files, ODTs, and spreadsheets, ODS, the spreadsheet, yeah. And Microsoft, who basically put up a competing one, OOXNL format, which is essentially the basis of DocX and so forth. And that was kind of interesting because there was an allegation that Microsoft actually paid companies to vote for their ISO standard, which is really quite interesting. Anyway, if you want to know all about the different open file formats for documents and so forth, and the LibreOffice Microsoft war, this is actually quite a neat little video. It's only 10 minutes long or something, so well worth looking at. And talking about documents, Stefan has an interesting document preparation system that he's going to talk about. So, Stefan, go ahead and share your screen.
Okay. So, do you see my title slide?
Yes, we do. Thanks.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about a software package called LaTeX, and it's a document preparation system. So the problem I had was while I was studying for my master's degree at Laval University 35 years ago, like in 1998 to 1990, I had to write a thesis, and the word processing of that time and probably most of the current modern word processor like Word will not be able to do these tasks. So the first one was to display numbered, so put a number at the end of a complex mathematical equation, and at the same time that I can easily reference that equation number in the text. Display table that can contain text, image, equation that also can be easily referenced in the text, and more importantly, automatically positioned in the document. Like if I say I want the table and the figure to be always on the top of the page, LaTeX will do that. Image, graphic, same thing that can be easily referenced in the text and automatically positioned in the document. Format, bibliographic item based on the type of reference, because book and article will use a different type of format or you write the bibliographic entry, and that can be easily referenced in the text. So if I add a new entry, a new book that I need to reference, it's easy to do. So I was looking for another solution than using a word processor and do all of these things by hand. And a colleague suggests that I look at LaTeX. So why LaTeX? Word processing and typesetting are two different things. LaTeX is far superior to setting large documents, basically formatting documents. And it is what it was designed for. You can write something in LaTeX and add it to a book publisher or a magazine, and you will be able to publish it without a whole lot of work. It was written to deal with the deficiencies of digital typesetting software of the time and has become the de facto standard for setting publication in math, computer science, physics, and many other fields. The big advantage is you can focus on the content and not worry about the layout or the formatting of the text. By default, LaTeX will generally do an excellent job at handling the layout details for you. On this chart, you see as your document complexity, like if you have like 100 page document to write with lots of mathematical equation, table, figure, a lot of biographic item, it's probably worthwhile to learn how to use LaTeX, because with Word, as you can see on that curve, the time to do that correctly on Word almost grow exponentially compared to LaTeX can do the job. But at the beginning, to write a letter, for example, it may LaTeX, you need to learn how the command and stuff like that. So it may not be worthwhile. LaTeX is based on TeX. And TeX is a typesetting program which was designed and written by a computer scientist at Stanford University, Professor Donald Knott, and first released in 1978. LaTeX is a set of commands that is a macro, if you want, that use the TeX coding, and it make we don't need to know TeX to use LaTeX. You just need to know the LaTeX command. LaTeX was created by Leslie Lamport in the 1980s. And if you really want to learn about how to use LaTeX in more details, you really need to look at that book. It was written by the guy that invented it. So it's pretty good. It's very good. Over the years, not only like that, the book only covered the function that LaTeX provide out of the box, but people on the internet have been added or creating package that add functionality to LaTeX, and two of them that I use a lot. There is one that is called acronym. So you define an acronym once with the short form and the long form, and throughout your document, you only use the short form, and LaTeX will expand it the first time that you use it in the document. So if you start moving text around that you have defined an acronym, and this happens often, and you realize, oh, that acronym, I didn't expand it at the beginning, so you don't need to worry about that. LaTeX can take care of that for you if you use that package. Another one is to have a long table that are longer than the page. There is package so you can have a very long table that will go over many pages in your documents. I will go through the commands that you can do. There is many more, but these are the big ones. With those, you can probably write a document. The general format of a command, they all start with backslash, and you have the command names. And in square bracket, you will have the option to that command. And in curly bracket, you will have the argument. Like, for example, the command document class, you tell LaTeX what style of formatting you want to use. The argument will be the style. So, and the option may be, I want to use a font size of 12 or 11 or whatever size you want. For the document, you're going to start with begin document and end document, and you're going to insert all of your commands in between these two statements. You can have an include command. And so when I wrote my thesis, I broke down each chapter was basically a file. So the main document that I call thesis had a bunch of include statement that was including each of the chapter one by one. If you want to do a title page, they will have a command like /title that you put the title you want, author text, and the date. And when you do the command make title, you will make a title page. If you want to generate content and lists, for example, the table of content, the command is /table of content for list of figure, /list of figure, table, list of table. When you create a very complex document, you can have parts, chapter, section, subsection, and keep going with all of these subsections. You don't need to worry about giving it a number. LaTeX will take care of you, and the formatting of the number will be determined on the style sheet that you're using. So if I want to create a new chapter, I just do /chapter, and I put the title of the chapter between curly brackets, and LaTeX will take care of the formatting, giving it a number, and all of the good stuff. Example of commands. So if you want to do a cross-reference, you just put a command label, and you give it a name. And later on in your document, you can use /ref and you use the label name. And there's option that you can do that you can get on what page that label is, either the section number or the title of it. So you can do a lot of things. And when you use those, this is what LaTeX will use to make sure that your figure or table will never appear before you make a reference to it. And, or you will be on the same page. You can do mathematical equations. So you start with begin equation, and this is an example of an equation. You need to learn the keyword to use. But something that was very useful for me, like if I use the in Word or PowerPoint equation editor, each time I need to go get a Greek letter, I need to do 5 more clicks before I found the character set. And after that, in there, I need to look for the exact letter I want. I need to click on it. So with this, at least I know if I want the theta, the Greek letter, I can just write /theta and I will get the theta. And all the other one, I can probably type that faster than clicking all of the things to get that letter inserted in Word. If I want a label, so I can reference that equation, I just put a label, the command label, and they give it a name, and an equation finish that section. And that command that we have, this command here, generate this equation. So you can really generate really fancy equation. For figure, very similar, begin figure. This one is a command to include the graphic. So you can, if you have a file that has the image or the diagram you want to import, you can include it. It will decide the size that you want, or you can specify a size that you want for that figure, the space you want to allocate. If you want a caption to that figure, like figure one and the name of the title, this is, you use the command caption. Again, if you want to be able to reference that figure in the text, you use a label. You don't need to give it a number. You just give it a name or a small acronym, and you can use that to reference it in your text. For table, very similar, begin table. And the tabular section is where you define the column that you want on your table, the type of line you want, the information you want in each of these rows or cell in the table. So this is where you do that information. Same thing, caption, label. For the bibliographic data, you need to create a .bib file. And in there, you create entries in text for each of the bibliographic items you want to use. And you start with the %, the commercial A, and either like if it's a book, you use book, article, so there is a manual that explains to you all the type of bibliographic type that you can, that exists in LaTeX. So book is one that I use often. The first entry you put, like the Adam 79, is the label you want to use for it. So when you're going to do a citation of that entry, you're going to use that keyword that you put in there. After that, author, you just with equate sign, with question mark, and you put whatever the authors are, the title, the curly bracket around that H, only tell LaTeX, I don't want you to change the case of the letter, leave it an uppercase. the year published, the publisher, and you finish that entry, and you keep adding entries in your BIB file with all the books or articles that you want to reference. And in your, and BibTeX will take care of the formatting. If it's a book or an article, the formatting is different. And also, you will take care, your BIB file can have like 30 or as many as you want, but in your main document, you may only use 10. You want to only get these 10, and you will sort them automatically. So if you add one later on, and you will sort them in the order that you reference them in your main document. If you want to cite a reference, you use the command backslash cite, and in curly bracket, you put the name of the label. So that will be, like, if you compile this, you will say this book, square bracket, and if it's the first article that we reference, it will be one square bracket. It's amazing. If you want to, sometimes you want to say, oh, it's reference one, but page 450 of that book. So you can do that with the optional argument with this. The tiled here is a unbreakable space, so the p.45 and the space will always stay like a word if you want. LaTeX won't try to cut it. You don't need to use other references, just the one that are used in your current document. What I will show you is the input file that you need to do and all the other temporary file that is being produced to generate a PDF at the end. So the first thing you need to produce is a number of text files. So they are text files basically that contains all the commands that you want to use to create your document. After that, you need to either find a style file that describes the formatting that you want, or what I did in my case, I found a thesis style from a university in the US, I think, and I modify it. So that's why to me, the formatting that the university wanted. And so that's why I edited that file to match my need, basically. So that's why I put the color red and blue. And you need to create your BIB file for all your bibliographic entry. So on the software you're using, it will be like something like that, a button you can click to say go, begin compiling all of these. The first thing that will happen is LaTeX will go and read the text file and the style. So basically that the instruction on how to format, and it will create a .aux file for each of the text files. So if you have 10 files ending with a .tex extension, it will create 10 files with the aux extension, one for each of the input file. After that, it will call the BibTeX program using your bib entry, and so in there, they will know which label from this they want to pull in and create the formatting. So this is what BibTeX will do. And BibTeX will produce another temporary file that it is a .bbl file. And after that, all of these are going to be called again in LaTeX. And with this is how you can figure out, oh, the first time you encounter backslash a chapter or something like that, he knows what number to give to it, basically. And after that, the LaTeX at that time will produce a PDF file that you can open with any PDF reader. So the environment, there is many implementation of tech and LaTeX. There is a lot of documentation available with many examples, even on YouTube or something like that. So if you're looking for something, how to do something, it's relatively easy to be able to find how to do things. There are spell and grammar checker available, because if you use a regular spell check, all the LaTeX command will give you errors that it's not something they recognize. So there is grammar, speller and grammar that have been modified to handle the LaTeX command. The one that I use, it's called MerkTeX, and I will show you two screenshots on the next slides. So this is what the main input screen looked like. So you type basically your LaTeX command. So here I said I wanted to use the formatting, the article, the titles, simple, simple, the author, my name, that today, and my begin document, make the title page, begin the equation. That's basically the same text that I showed you on the previous slide, and equation and document. And when you're done, you can save it, and you can click on the green triangle, and it will start compiling. And at the bottom here, the screen will split, and it will show you what it's doing. And if you encounter any error message, you need to go in and correct it. And if everything goes correctly, it will generate a PDF file that basically, like all the input I provided, simple file, my name, and that equation that I showed before. There's also other tools, like if you use the spell checker, the grammar that support LaTeX, they will be able to, like using variable color coding, tell you if there is a spelling errors, that kind of things, or like if you put space where they shouldn't have a space or something like that. So you can do some of the function that like Word is doing, basically. I will show you some output from my thesis and basically the command that generated those. So the make title, I had to input all of these in the, as I show you for the other page. And when you do the make title, it generated that page. Basically, it was the cover of the page, and it followed all the various roles that the university wanted to follow. The title had to be in capital letters, underlined, and all of these formatting instructions. When it was the time to generate a table of content or the list of figures, I just put these command and automatically LaTeX begin to generate them. And the formatting, all the space, the type of like the size, the bold, and all of these things, it follow the style file. In the thesis, they love to put a lot of space, so it followed that. Like when it was time to create my first chapter, I just did the command / chapter and in curly bracket introduction, and automatically LaTeX used the formatting that was specified in the style file to generate chapitre. So I had to translate those because it was an English program, and the number was automatically decided because it was the first time you encountered a chapter, so you give it a number 1. Like the fact that you use Roman numbers, again, it's defined in the style sheet, and introduction is these word is the one that appeared there, and basically all the text. This is an example of a table, so defining all the columns, what you want, double line and stuff like that. The caption, basically, that number was done automatically. It was a second table in the second chapter that he encountered. Sorry, the first table in the second chapter, so he gave it the number 2.1, and I put a label on it. So if I want to reference it in the text, I say, like, in table 2.1, you can see the caption. This is an example of a formula. And with the number, again, the number I added automatically, and I can easily reference them in text. I can say something like, oh, equation 2.1 is modified with this to get another equation or something like that. LaTeX also has its own set of basic drawing commands, and you can make the diagram. So, and I was able with the basic command to do basically that electric diagram, basically. And again, give the caption and stuff like that. This is an example of a more complex table that had equation in it. So LaTeX was able to do that. I have another table in the thesis that has a graph in each cell has graph inside. So LaTeX was able to do it easily. This is an example how a reference to a document shows up. So on this one, I use the optional to indicate the page. The command in LaTeX was just / site, and I gave the tag for that document. And when he compiled it, he found out it was the first reference I made. So you give it a number 1, and this page, it was given as an option to the site command. And at the end of the thesis, he lists all the reference. So he created, again, all the formatting is coming from the style file. And this was the format for a book. So for a book, you put the name of the book, who wrote it, and they just run the year, all of that good stuff. But if it would have been an article, you can see that the formatting is different. You put the author name and you put the name of the article in a quote, in italic, and after that, which journal, what volume, whatever, the date it was published and what page. So just that, it saved me hours of formatting, depending if it was a book or an article. Depending on the style that you're using, there's another document that I did that the section name was put in the on the header of each of the page. So as these were changing, the header was changing to reflect like in books, basically. So in a word, you can use words or you can use LaTeX and get a bit more style. And yes, there is a learning curve, but if you're writing a long document and you want to focus on the text more than fighting with the formatting, LaTeX is a good choice.
Okay, thanks, Stefan. One of the questions was actually, how long did it take you to learn to use LaTeX?
Not that long, because that book here, from Mr. Lamport, that book was a very good introduction. So just to get the system up and running, and I didn't start writing a big thing. There was a small demo in there, and I began to learn the command and stuff like that. The worst thing, I guess, was the French letters with accent. It does not, LaTeX does not support letter with accents. So if you put an E, like on your keyboard, you press the E with an accent aigu, and on a text file, it will show up okay. But LaTeX will say, I don't recognize that character. You only use the basic ASCII set. There is a way to make a letter with accent, stuff like that, but each command is about 5 characters long. So what I did is I was using a text file that I was putting all the LaTeX command with the accents, and I wrote a small program that was translating the accent into text command, generating the text file, and after that, that's these files I was sending to the to LaTeX. So I created a batch file that automates all of this. Learning the command with just what I showed you there, you probably have already a good 70% of the command you will need. For the table and the equation, obviously you will need to learn how to do things, but when you do one, the other one gets easier.
And another question, Stefan, was whether you have to use all English commands to create your French document.
The command remain English, begin document, but everything in, for the caption here, like a title, I could use whatever I want. The author, I could write whatever I want. The date, I could use whatever I want. The table of content, what I had to do was to edit the style file and find out where the formatting command for the table of content was, and change the name that was in English to French. And after that, he began to, when he created the document, instead of saying table of content, he said it in French, basically. So I had to do some editing, but it was relatively easy because I looked at the style file and I did a search for a table of content and I found it right away. That's what he's doing. So I just changed that and it began to work.
So your style file is also dependent on the language that you want to produce.
In my case, and when I did it, 30 years ago, it was only in English. Maybe today, they may have some that support more language. I don't know.
And another question was, essentially, can you use any series of letters as an acronym?
If you load the...
It would be like, Nazi unit. Does it...
So to use that package, you need to download it from the internet you need to add it as a command to say use that the package acronym. And after that, it's a backslash, I think acronym or something like that, and you put The first argument, I think, is the short form of the acronym, and the other argument is the long extended meaning of the acronym. And after that, the short name of the acronym become a command in LaTeX. So you just do backslash the short acronym, and everywhere you use that, the acronym starting with a backslash. And when you at LaTeX compile your document, if it's the first time you use it, for example, if I use acronym in chapter 2, it will expand it there. But after that, revising the text, I said, I need to introduce it in chapter 1. I still use, like when I write the document, I'm just still using backslash the name of the acronym. But when LaTeX compile it, it will now expand it in chapter 1 because this is the first time it's being referenced. Another thing I've done is I modified that class and I copied the code to generate a table of content. And instead of looking for the content, I said, look for these acronym. And I had I created a new command that was list of acronym. And it gave me all the acronym that I use in my thesis, which was a great help because as soon as I created one, I did not need to worry about creating the list. The list was going to be automatic.
Okay, thank you very much, Stefan. See if we can take over. Okay, so I think my connection isn't working very well tonight at points, so I'm hoping Chris will take over at some point.
I'll be happy to take it over anytime you just say the word and I'll do it.
Well, tell me if it's really bad.
No, you can't say the word. You have to say LaTeX.
We're talking about, yeah. The first thing that came in was one of the loony links to a Canadian website. And this is a set of videos from the city of Ottawa, which are quite interesting. And if you always wondered what happened to green bins and blue bins and so forth, Ottawa's green bin program will tell you all about that. Another typo for you, Chris. Anyway, there's the link, and there's a whole bunch of videos there, which will tell you all about Ottawa's waste programs. And a kind of an option to that is this website that is trying to reduce the amount of food waste. And so there are a whole raft of options here for how to plan meals, how to make sure you use everything that you buy, and tips on how to keep things fresh for longer periods of time, I guess. So the website was on the earlier slide. Take a look at that too. And now we have a share. Chris has to talk.
Yeah, so this one here, it should have been one of my rants. But at any rate, I ran into a Windows 11 upgrade failure, which was a curiosity. So I have an Acer Predator PO3600. So I purchased it July of 2019, and Windows Update has been saying for over a year or about a year that why not upgrade to Windows 11? You're good to go. And so, you know, I thought, whoops, go back. Here we go. Jumping back and forth too much. Okay, so I wondered, is it really ready? So I ran the PC health check just to double check, and it came up with green check marks for everything. It's supporting secure boot, it has TPM, it is supported processor, and it has enough memory, disk space, and all the rest of it. So I figured, okay, that really was good to go. So I did a fresh backup just to make sure if things go south in the middle of it, I can always recover to the state the computer was in before I did the upgrade. And then I started the upgrade. And it took a long time to actually run. And after a couple of hours, it failed and it rolled back. It actually rolled back very quickly. Probably took less than 10 minutes to roll back successfully to Windows 10. and everything was working fine. So, I mean, the rollback was successful, and it did bring me back to Windows 10. But then I wondered, you know, why did it actually fail? Because according to the upgrade page and the health check, it should have been fine. So I checked online for some of the common fixes, NVIDIA drivers. Video drivers is one of the things mentioned frequently, that if you're having problems, update that. I checked in Device Manager to see if there were any warnings about drivers that were failing. I ran Windows Update Troubleshooter, no problems. I ran DISM and SFC, System File Checker, to see if there were any problems there, no problems. And in the reading, there were some discrepancies about whether there was a BIOS update available for that particular computer or not. And so I couldn't really tell for sure. So then I got a little bit more specific. So I went to Perplexity AI and I said, does Acer support upgrading from Windows 10 to Windows 11 on that specific model of PC? And it quite quickly came back and said, no. So Acer does not support it upgrading. The official guidance, they say it's not listed on their upgrade compatibility tables for models that can be upgraded to Windows 11, and they recommended to stick with Windows 10. There are some indications that it may allow the upgrade to actually function. The base hardware requirements are met, but some people said operational issues due to missing outdated drivers can occur, and blue screen errors and device instability can actually happen if you manage to successfully upgrade it to Windows 11. So the recommendations are to continue using Windows 10 on that computer, and they say any attempt to upgrade that to Windows 11 could come up and bite you about it. And this was the thing that, to me, was critical. Operational issues due to missing or outdated drivers may arise, and blue screen errors. Blue screen errors don't tend to happen immediately and consistently, and so you could end up with these weird errors just happening later on. So if you try to do an upgrade and it fails and it rolls back, I would recommend that in all likelihood, just believe that you are never going to be able to upgrade that PC to Windows 11. And that's all I had on that.
Harvey says that rather than using update, he only uses the Windows 11 installation assistant.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that would have helped me in this particular instance, but you know, it is another way of doing the upgrade. It should fundamentally do the same thing, but at any rate, I'm happy to go with the advice that I now see that it's not supported by Acer, and therefore don't try it. And for this particular PC, it is going to end up getting one more year of support from Microsoft, and then it will get recycled.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. So I had an option here. I'll try and get through this thing. I actually had a couple of my friends. One of them wanted Linux installed on her Windows 10 machine, and the other one wanted to buy a brand new machine with Windows 11. So I was looking at how do I get rid of the old machine, and I remembered that Dave Plummer, the ex-Microsoft software engineer, had this video on before Windows 10 dies altogether or end of life comes, that you should get the installation drive, get the installation disk, so that if you do need to install Windows 10 again, you have the installation media available just in case Microsoft don't support that when they drop support for Windows 10. So basically what I wanted to do was a fresh install of Windows on this machine to essentially blow everything away. And to do that, you need this media creation tool. And it's a good idea to download it right now because it may not be available when you want it, or we don't know that. So better safe than sorry, get it now. And the tool is a 22H2 version for me anyway. And you need an 8 GB USB drive to install the software. And to get that, you have to go to the Microsoft website. And the installation disk is available for both 11 and 10, and clearly I want 10. And then that in turn links you to another Windows page, download the Windows 10 website page. So you have to go there and find this download now button and download the software and save it to a USB drive. And then basically, there are some instructions on how to do it, and this is for a machine that has Windows 10 already licensed. You need to do it differently if you're looking for a completely different machine. And then there's a whole bunch of instructions on how to actually run this installation media program. And it's quite a long, complicated, well, it's a long process and a whole bunch of steps. So first thing it tells you, it's getting a few things ready. Then you have to accept the license terms that it offers to you. And then you have to decide what you want to do. And the option I wanted was upgrade, because the other option is to create an installation medium for a different computer. But I'm not really upgrading. I'm doing a fresh install. But it doesn't say fresh install. It says upgrade. So I tell it upgrade, and then I hit next, and off it goes. And so it starts downloading a whole bunch of stuff, the actual Windows 10 software. Then it has to verify it, and then it creates on your USB drive the Windows 10 installation media. And then it has to clean things up, and then it restarts. So that takes the first little while. You can see my little tortoise there. Downloading Windows and doing all that stuff takes quite a long time. So it reboots, and it starts preparing things, and it says it's getting updates again. I don't know why it does it again. And then it checks the PCs, get ready to go, and it gets some stuff ready. And it shows you some license terms again. So, okay, I have to accept the license terms. Then it tells me to choose what to keep, but it doesn't give me any choice. It goes and gets some more updates. Can never have too many updates, I guess. Again, make sure I'm ready to install. Make sure the PC's got enough space. And finally, it says it's ready to install. And now I have to change, I have to decide what to keep. And the options are to keep your personal files and apps. And I think by apps, it only means Microsoft Store apps, because third-party apps, I think you have blown away. You could keep your personal files only, or the alternative is don't keep anything. So I chose nothing because I really wanted a blank machine at the end of this thing. So then once I've done that, it goes and gets some more updates. It gets ready to install it. I didn't touch a thing. I did not touch a thing.
Sorry, I might have actually done that accidentally.
Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, basically he goes through that whole getting updates thing again, and I wonder whether that's because I chose nothing, rather I changed the default option to nothing from keep personal files and apps. So maybe I had to suffer that one more time. And finally it says it's ready to install. So now we actually get into the installation, and it tells you that the PC is going to restart several times, it's going to reboot, and it's going to take a while, and sure enough it does. And there will be a series of questions, and you have to tell it what region you're in, what kind of keyboard you want, whether you want voice control or not, if you have a second keyboard. And then the next one is important, or at least I think it's important. It's important for me. Do I want to connect to the network? If you tell it, if you connect to the network, then it's going to force you later on to use a Microsoft account in order to continue. So I chose, I don't have internet. And then it says, well, you can continue with a limited setup. But that means that later on, I can set up a local account, which is what I wanted, rather than a Windows account. Who's going to use the PC? I told it it was going to be somebody called admin. A memorable password, I told it was going to be admin because this machine was going to be given away or sent to e-waste or something. Confirm the password. Give it some security questions. I gave it completely nonsensical answers. I didn't let it use my location, find my device, diagnostic data, inking and typing. Didn't want tailored experience. Didn't want advertising ID. And interestingly, it says, do you want to let Cortana help you get things done? But Cortana's been deprecated, so I'm not quite sure how that works. anyway, it's your choice as to what you do when you're doing a fresh install of Windows. And then it will say, just a moment, almost done. Got a few, polish up a few things and get things ready. And we're almost ready and nearly ready, but don't turn off your PC and stay, wait a minute. And we're almost here. And then you finally get the Windows boot screen, which I thought was interesting because when I do these Linux presentations, I always say that Linux comes up in its glorious splendor because it's just a colored desktop, a black desktop actually in Linux with a couple of icons. Well, it turns out if you do a fresh install of Windows, you get a blue desktop and a couple of icons. So there you go. So if you want to do a fresh install, it's a long process, but pretty simple. Just follow the bouncing ball. Okay, Chris.
And I think the point of making sure, especially if you're sticking with Windows 10, get a copy of the install media now in case you ever have to reinstall it, because Microsoft might pull the ISOs for Windows 10. And so make sure you have a copy or you know somebody else who has a copy just in case you need it. Okay, I came across this it was just published yesterday. Consumer Reports, a little bit late to the game, but they had some words for Microsoft. So they are calling on Microsoft to extend support for Windows 10. And you see the highlighted things on here. They're calling for the support to be extended, and they want Microsoft to provide free extended support for consumers who have not or cannot make the transition and continue providing that support for free until more users, whatever that means, have transitioned off of Windows 10. Oh, and I should paste this into the chat. So the highlights from the actual letter that they sent to Microsoft, they have this linked in the article, and the highlights on the actual letter, there are computers that are incapable of running Windows 11 still available for sale in 2022 and 2023. Keep in mind that Windows 11 only came out in 2021, so only 4 years ago. So that's a big deal, I think. And my clicking is not doing it. There we go. As of August, 46.2% of people worldwide still using Windows 10, which constitutes about 646.8 million people based on Microsoft's estimates on how many people are using Windows. And there's an estimated 200 to 400 million PCs that can't be upgraded to Windows 11. So they say, and I agree with this, decision to make Windows 11 incompatible with existing hardware and only 4 years notice is incompatible with consumer expectations of Microsoft's own history. Microsoft has usually bent over backwards to do backward compatibility. But here, less than 4 years from the end of life of Windows 10, they declared that all of these Windows 10 machines are not compatible with Windows 11. So that to me is a big deal. And finally, come on, click. can you advance it one?
Advance it, I'll go back.
Was that the last one? Okay, yeah. Can you go? Yeah, okay. So they say that arguing that Windows 11 is an essential upgrade to boost cybersecurity, which is what Microsoft is hanging on the idea that Windows 11 is an important upgrade and why you have to get off of Windows 10. And they say doing that while also leaving hundreds of millions of machines more vulnerable to cyber attacks is hypocritical. And I definitely agree with that. Now, this is really late to the game, but who knows? It may influence them over this next year that they will decide to extend it again so that Windows 10 users can continue to use their perfectly good PCs using Windows 10 before they have to upgrade to a new computer. So, interesting article, worth reading.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chris. One more. I'm going to skip that article right there. We only have a minute to go, so I've got a few things in the wrap-up. So let me just tell you that I'm looking for presentations for the monthly meeting program. And we're actually good to go right now through February of next year. And for, you know, March through May, our June meeting will be the pizza queue type thing again. Any computer-related topic, the monthly meetings are 90 minutes, so fairly lengthy presentation, including questions, though. And shorter is acceptable because I can always get Chris to do something, can't I, Chris? We'll find something to fill it out with. We'll have a Q&A session or something if you can't fill the hour and a half. Anyway, if you have any interest in that, please send me an email, aaron.german@opcud.ca. And one of the meetings I'm thinking about for the spring is Members' Favorites. So this is a kind of a heads up. Members' Favorites is a whole sequence of brief presentations, kind of 10 to 20 minutes. They're basically share type things. Any topics, software, hardware, operating systems, whatever. And we'll have a lot more information about that if we decide to go that route later on in the year. Coming up, we have some Ottawa Library presentations. Chris is going to be doing Protecting Your PC on Monday at Carlingwood. And the Battle of the Titans is I'm going to do the Windows 10 End of Life presentation on Zoom at through the library on the same day. So the session last Wednesday, it's basically the same presentation, unless I get my extended security update offer over the weekend. I can add some slides on that. Otherwise, it's the same presentation on Zoom. But you have to register for all the library ones, and especially for Zoom, because you need to get the link from the library. And then on September 23rd, because it's busy this week, and the next day, Tuesday, he's going to be doing something on AI at Ruthie Dickinson. All right, I'll be here next week, but after that, I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks, so I'm not going to be able to do Q&A. Chris will be looking after the shop, but what's he going to do? There's nothing in the pipeline right now. He could certainly use some help, and so he's looking for shares. So if you have a topic like LaTeX that you'd like to share with the group at Q&A, just tell us what the title is, maybe a few lines about the content, and I'm sure Chris will be happy to include you in one of those Q&A sessions. And again, we'll talk more about that next week too. Talking about next week, that is our next Q&A session, Wednesday, September 24th. So again, if you have questions or follow-ups on things we've talked about tonight, new topics that you'd like to share with the group, our suggestion box address is always open for business. And I hope everybody enjoyed the stuff we had tonight. Pretty full agenda as usual, and we kind of rushed through most of it. So thank you very much for attending, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.